Leo Castelli played a major role in shaping the history of post-war American art. The influential art dealer discovered and championed Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, Frank Stella, Roy Lichtenstein, and other artists now considered among the most important of that era. A new biography, Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli, by Annie Cohn-Salal, examines how he came to be so powerful and how he changed the way art was sold in this country. It's published by Knopp, and I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Cohn-Salal back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
You previously wrote a well-received biography of Jean-Paul Sartre, which was a bestseller in France, wasn't it?
It was published in 25 languages. It was a bestseller, yeah, in many countries, in the Netherlands, in Germany, in Spain, yeah.
In places where people care about philosophers.
Intellectuals. But I think that Leo and Sartre have a lot in common.
Oh, really? Oh, yes. I was going to ask why you chose to write about an art dealer. Did you know him personally?
Yes. I came to the United States because of Jean-Paul Sartre in 1989. It's a long story, but anyway.
As a cultural
counselor of the French embassy, I was representing French culture in this country, and I was interested in the life of, you know, of culture. Within 10 days at the embassy, I was invited for dinner by someone, and at the dinner was Leo Castelli. I knew very few people in New York at the time, in the United States also. And Leo was there sitting with a girlfriend. We were six people at the dinner. He was charming. He was witty. He was extremely well-read. He was extremely elegant. He was very generous. And immediately he looked at me and said, "You do not look like your predecessors, who were all men in gray suit with gray ideas. You're going to take New York City by storm and I'll help you. But I'll teach you also American art and I'll start tomorrow. I have a show with Roy. You come to the gallery and you stay for dinner." And I said, "That's it." I love the way he introduced himself, and he really welcomed me in his network. And I can tell you, Lena, definitely, that I dropped French intellectuals to the art world. Since that day, I've been putting my attention, my focus, and my research and my tools to understand art and art in America.
Although 1989 was rather late in the story of Leo Castelli as an art dealer, his importance occurs in the late 50s and the early 60s, where he introduces us to so many important artists at a time when the French were getting a little upset at the fact that everybody was saying, well, all the important art is in America now, not in France anymore.
Very true, very true. So what Leo does, he is a bridger. He is a character coming completely out of Europe and out of Renaissance Europe.
Do you think it's partly because he comes from Trieste? He was born in Trieste, which is a city in itself that's kind of not here, not there?
Totally. Yeah, I completely agree. Trieste was at the border of many different worlds, especially at the border of also many different times, because it was the harbor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire before World War I. When Leo was a little boy. And then after World War I, it becomes part of Italy. And it becomes a remote city with no interest at all for the Kingdom of Italy. So Leo, as a little boy, is experiencing that. He's all the pulses, all the fights, all the disentanglements of Europe. So his life really follows all the echoes of the historical moments of Europe.
He's also Jewish, with a family background that is partly German. And I was reminded that another very important art figure from Trieste was Italo Svevo, who was a Jewish businessman who happened to write one of the most important novels of the 20th century, Confessions of Zeno. He was discovered by James Joyce. So there was something going on among Jews in that area. But Castelli didn't change the name. His family did.
Yeah. I mean, also Svevo had another name. He was called Ettore Smith, you know. And you're right. It's very important to put Castelli in his original context, which is Trieste, literature, and history. And he was born Leo Kraus, K-R-A-U-S-Z. But it was the name of his father. And they changed their name during the Mussolini era when the Italians wanted to Italianize the names of the Jews and they took the mother's name. His mother was called Castelli. But he was not German. I'm sorry he was Austro-Hungarian, but of German language.
Although the family also had strong Tuscan roots, you say.
The mother came from a village in Tuscany that I went to inquire about and discovered, and it was extraordinary to discover that they were already involved in selling paper to the artists of the time, the Castelli brothers.
So did he grow up in a world that was his family involved in art?
Absolutely not. The ancestors were, but you know, and you also, but they were like bourgeois people, but not specially well read. It's when he married at the age of 23, this girl called Elena Shapira, the daughter of the most important industrialist in Romania, Elena Shapira will become Elena Zonabend, that he integrates with her his interest in literature and her interest in art, and they become a very, very interesting couple.
And Zonabend becomes an important name in American art gallery world as well.
Yes, but when
was he doing in Bucharest?
You know,
was it that easy, just move around all the time?
The point was that he wanted to become, to get a PhD in comparative literature. The thing he was the most interested in was Complete. But his father said, before you do that, you have to listen to me and go into the insurance business. So Leo goes into the insurance business that he hates at the Assicurazione Generale. And Trieste was the head of this insurance business. He hated it, but he was sent to Bucharest just for another position. That's all. But he it was not his love.
And then he, newly married, moved to Paris, where one of their neighbors was Vasily Kandinsky?
In Neuilly, yes. Kandinsky during the last years of his life. Yes, yes, yes. The Castellis were living a grand life. Elena was extremely rich. They had excellent taste, you know, custom furniture, and they had a gallery. Leo opened a gallery for a very short time, Place Vendôme. There's the worst address, right? Between Schiaparelli and the Ritz Hotel. In 1939, we had a very interesting show with surrealists and who had made for him, like Salvador Dali, some furniture. It was a very, very cute little show. And then the life starts. The war starts.
So they were forced to flee. They came to the United States.
They were Jews. They were forced into the United in 1941.
And he volunteered for the army.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And because he knew a lot of languages, he was sent to something called USIA and to Romania, where he gained actually his American nationality by being a spy, basically, with the Americans to stop the Russians or the Soviet Union to come into Romania. But Leo didn't manage, as you know.
Do we know what happened to his family during this period?
You know, that's a very important point. You said Leo was Jewish. Very few people knew he was Jewish, and Leo was, if you want, he was accepting to say that he was Jewish, but his father and mother were stuck in Budapest during the siege of Budapest, and they had to flee. They had to cross the Danube swimming, and they were drowned. His mother was drowned in the Danube, and his father was amputated and put in a common grave, which for this bourgeois family was terrible. And actually, Leo never said that to anybody. It's something that he completely, he kept for himself. I discovered it through his nephew. And, you know, in a way, that's one of the things which moved me so much, because Leo had a very opaque personality. He was charming, he was interesting, but very composed. And you never knew the depths of his feelings. But when I discovered that, I understood how he composed himself as a totally American citizen, and decided that, you know, the pains of the Jews from Europe were not part of his life. And I respect that.
My guest is Annie Cohen-Salal, whose latest book is Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli, which is published by Knopf. And you say in your introduction that your research on this project, it was like a criminal investigation. So you knew Leo, but he wasn't telling you any of these things? Some of these stories are fascinating. You'd think that he'd want to charm people with stories of his past.
Yeah, he would drop some anecdotes here and there. But, you know, the most interesting one, the most dramatic ones, you know, he never told anyone. And I think that's even, you know, it's back to Jean-Paul Sartre. Sartre wrote on Flaubert, and he said, one steps into a dead man as in a windmill. The important thing is to start with a question. So when Leo was dead, I started to step in, I stepped into his life. And
what was the question?
The question was, what made him an American icon?
Because, okay, so all
don't
of this
don't you agree
would,
he was an icon?
Yes, and he also is, despite the fact that he always had an accent and he always dressed like a European.
Absolutely.
He is so important to the history of American art, not to European art. You would assume that he, like many other émigrés who decided to open art galleries, would have been bringing the art, Picasso or Matisse or whatever, over.
Sure.
Instead, he discovers all of these young American artists. But he did begin representing Kandinsky, didn't he?
It's true. It's true. Because with the gallery he had opened in Paris had access to Kandinsky's many, many, many paintings. So the man in Paris would roll the paintings, give them to the pilot of the flight, you know, Paris, New York. Leo would pick them up, I mean, nail them and sell them to the Guggenheim.
So here is this man who's described as old world and European, and he concentrates on American art, but not only concentrates on it, has an incredible eye for what's going to be important. Now, in some cases, these artists were already establishing themselves, but in other cases, he seems to have been the first person to have recognized their importance.
Listen, Jasper Johns had not showed. He had showed two paintings at the Jewish Museum that Leo saw. It was an epiphany for him. And he absolutely fell in love with Jasper's work, which was, he was his fetish artist all his life.
Well, he also knew Robert Rauschenberg, and Johns and Rauschenberg lived in the same building.
Exactly.
So that there was an obvious connection. But he also was friendly with Pollock and de Kooning, who represented the earlier generation.
That was before. That was before. You know, Leo opened his gallery at the age of 50. And before the age of 50, he was a kind of the rich husband, the husband of a rich woman. And he was an amateur, a dilettante, not very interesting. And all of a sudden, when he decides to open his gallery, he's launching himself in a completely different way. When he was friendly with Pollock and de Kooning in the 50s, he helped them organize their career, change dealer. He told them to go with Sidney Janis. But one day, de Kooning told Leo, Leo, you'll open a gallery soon and you'll show me. But his wife, Ileana, said, no, Bill. Leo will certainly open a gallery, but he will not show you because Leo wants to discover new artists.
And he also created a new way of paying artists. He would pay them monthly stipends rather than just a percentage of the painting, as most galleries were.
Absolutely. That's a fascinating thing. Leo was never interested in money, never became rich.
Well, he had a rich wife, so he never had to worry.
When he started his gallery, they got a divorce and he started his gallery. Then his interest was basically in changing the status of the artist in the United States. His interest was to help them produce. He admired them so much. He said they were my heroes. So he would do everything he could to support them and help them produce and show their work and do an extraordinary organization of archives, for example, all over the world, and select the best possible museums, institutions, collections.
He understood that you get these artists into museums. Mm-hmm. So when the Met opened its monumental show, New York Painting and Sculpture, 1940 to 1970, which is curated by Henry Geldzahler, mm-hmm. so many of the artists were from Costelli's stable. I mean, he was on the cusp of every big movement, pop, minimalism, conceptualism. But then in the later years, others came along. Did he lose it, or were they just being more aggressive?
Yeah. Something changed, Leonard, in 71 when Soho starts.
But he was one of the first galleries to move to Soho.
Totally. So Soho became a destination gallery. Leo became the brand name of Soho. And then when he became, in the 90s or the 80s, a lot more younger galleries came over. Mary Boone, Larry Gagosian, Jeffrey Deitch, Arnie Glimcher.
At Pace.
Yeah, exactly. And some of them were linked to Leo, some were not. But we can say that most of them were basically connecting to Leo as a model. I mean, what is so amazing is that whether with artists, with collectors, with dealers, with critics, everybody, or with colleagues, with his staff, everybody remembers Leo so fondly. I mean, because the man was, even his gallery was very was run in a very democratic way. You know, the collectors like Eli Broad in LA said to me, I came to New York once a month to have lunch with him on Saturday because he taught me everything. You know, I mean, you know how important Eli Broad is with his foundations.
And his new museum.
Yeah. And, you know, Castelli, basically somebody with no training at all, just he created his own myth and he imposed in America this new concept of the artist as somebody valuable.
Was he still dealing in art when he died in 1999?
He was very far away from that. You know, he had closed his gallery. He opened a very small space up. I saw him like a few weeks before he passed away. He was a frail man, but he still had incredible relationship with his artists, especially Jasper.
This Saturday, Annie Cohen Salal will be giving a talk and signing books in East Hampton as part of the East Hampton Library Authors Night at 5 o'clock. And then on Sunday, she will be doing the same at Books and Books at 6 o'clock in West Hampton. More details on our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Leo in a Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Lynette.